everyone. This is Cartoons to Castles,
the history behind the mouse and magic. I'm Melanie.
And I'm Jessica. We're best friends and Disney nerds who wanted to learn more about the history behind the Walt Disney Company's movies, shows, music, theme parks, and more, and share it all with you.
So thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Cartoons to Castles. I did the welcome back message this time instead of Jess. We're flipping it.
I know we are kind of flipping it. We don't do this on purpose, but it seems like it always just so happens that I get the portion of the episode that tends to go first, but you're talking first this time.
I know. I just really like Jess introducing the episodes. I don't know why. I think because I get nervous and Jess like introducing it helps calm me down.
Well, we have a very exciting treat. At least I think so, because this is a topic that I am very excited about. But
me too.
You guys in the Disney fan community may be familiar that June 26th is a holiday for us Disney fans.
Oh, it is.
Yes, it is a huge holiday. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, 626, June 26th, is aka Stitch Day, because Stitch Experiment 626. We are talking about the history of Lilo and Stitch.
Yay! One of our favorite Disney movies ever.
I love this movie so much. I knew we wanted to do this as a topic eventually. And of course, with it about to be June 26th, it fit so perfectly. And we're going to be talking about the making of the movie, as well as his appearances in theme park attractions and the fan culture. So lots of fun Stitch things coming your way this episode.
Yeah. And our Stitch fandom goes way back. Just I don't know when you first saw Lilo and Stitch, but I was already in my 20s when I saw it, and I just fell in love with the movie. I fell in love with Stitch, and there was a huge blow up balloon of Stitch at Disneyland at one point, and I was there with my family, and I was so excited to see it that I actually screamed, "Mommy!" I was in my 20s, let me remind you. And my mom started laughing and she was like, "Mommy." And I said, "I don't know what happened. I just lost my mind for a second, but I was very excited to see Stitch."
Yeah. And same about loving Stitch as soon as I saw it. I saw it as soon as it came out. I believe it came out on DVD and VHS. I'm pretty certain I had the VHS because it was like during that period, you know, where they were still, they were doing both. But I had it on VHS, watched it all the time. I did not get to see it in the theaters. You know, I was 12, so I got to go to the theaters when I was taken to the theater.
See movies when you could, yeah.
Yeah, so I never got to see it. And I was kind of bummed I never got to see it just because it in the theaters on the big screen, just because it is one of my favorites. But recently, just last month, my first movie going experience back since movie theaters have come back open. For those who aren't familiar, the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood is owned by Disney. They've owned it for several years now. It's where they typically do all their premieres. It's a beautiful Art Deco theater, and they only play Disney movies. And when they first opened, you know, before Cruella came out and before they had like a new release to play, they were opening up to private rentals, which they do anyway, but they had like tons of private rental time slots. And one of the offerings was Lilo and Stitch. So I rented out the theater and got to see Lilo and Stitch on the big screen. And I've seen Lilo and Stitch countless times, but let me tell you, it hit different on the big screen. It just, could like, those climaxes in the movie just felt so much bigger. And even though I've seen it so many times and the people with me had seen it so many times, everyone like had those kind of reactions and cheering as if they were watching it for the first time, because the theater kind of has that impact. So
yeah,
it's very exciting.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on a Hawaiian roller coaster ride. I'm going to take you through the making of Lilo and Stitch, and Jess is going to talk about the release of the movie and reactions and sort of the fan culture that's been built up around the movie. So Lilo and Stitch was co-written and co-directed by Dean DeBlois and Chris Sanders, and I have such a hard time pronouncing Dean's last name, so I will just casually refer to them as Dean and Chris from now on. Dean is a Canadian artist, writer, and filmmaker who started out at Don Bluth Studios in Ireland as a layout artist, character designer, and storyboard assistant. He worked on the 1994 films Thumbelina and A Troll in Central Park before leaving to work at Walt Disney Feature Animation's Florida studio as a storyboard artist. And as we talked about on other episodes, they used to have a whole other animation studio in Florida. So this is when they had that working at the time. Chris majored in character animation at California Institute of the Arts, also known as CalArts, and this was the college that was first conceived by Walt Disney and his brother Roy in 1961 and officially opened in 1970, and has trained many animators and artists who went on to work at Disney and Pixar. So it's kind of an animator factory, if you will. After graduating, Chris worked at Marvel Comics and also helped draw the characters for the original version of the Muppet Babies. He moved over to Walt Disney Feature Animation to work in the visual development department and then worked on both visuals and story for The Rescuers Down Under, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King before co-writing the screenplay and becoming head of story for Mulan. At one point during production of Mulan, Dean actually took over for Chris Sanders as head of story, and they ended up working together frequently on that script. So now that we've been introduced to Chris and Dean, let's move on to Lilo and Stitch. As Mulan was wrapping up and Disney Animation was looking for its next project, Michael Eisner held a corporate retreat at his mother's apple orchard in Vermont. Did you know that Michael? I'm sure you did know that Michael Eisner had an apple orchard where he held corporate
I
retreats.
knew that he did corporate retreats like that. I've heard about him doing a bunch in oh my gosh, what's the name of that place where rich people go in Colorado to like
Oh,
ski and
Aspen.
stuff? Yeah, like I knew he did corporate retreats in Aspen, but I think that might have been with more executive level people. I did not know about the apple orchard.
So he was holding a retreat here, and they were all picking apples together and talking about, the movies. And Eisner expressed an interest in trying to make an animated movie that was less of an epic and more of a smaller story with a smaller budget. And Thomas Schumacher, who was the president of Walt Disney Animation at the time, said he might have an idea and that he would get in touch with Eisner about it. He then approached Chris Sanders and was like, "Hey, do you have any ideas?" So he was like, "I have an idea. I'll go talk to Chris and see if he has an idea." And so going back in time a bit to the 80s before Chris worked at Disney, he had written and illustrated a children's book about an alien who landed in a forest and was trying to interact with all of the woodland creatures, and they wanted nothing to do with him. And no, I know. And I don't know if he submitted the book to any publishing companies or which ones, but Chris basically said the book pitch didn't work out, so he set it aside. So when the Florida Animation Studio was finishing up Mulan and Schumacher asked Chris if he had any stories to pitch, he thought of that children's book he'd written years before and the little alien character that, just kind of stayed in his mind as a character he wanted to revisit. When he began discussing the idea with Schumacher, he suggested that Chris put the alien in the human world to have more of a contrast between the culture and behavior of the alien and the ways that humans interact. Chris started developing the story kind of secretively off hours and soon brought Dean in to help him. Clark Spencer, who would go on to become the producer of the film, described Chris and Dean kind of like how people described Walt Disney and his brother Roy. It wasn't quite the same because Chris and Dean are both creatives and story people, but he said that Chris was always full of ideas and bouncing off the walls, and Dean was more of the grounded, chill guy, so they balanced each other out really well. So Chris and Dean began developing the story around the clock, often after hours. And then finally, the higher-ups at Disney Animation approached Dean and they were like, "Okay, we know you've been working on this story with Chris. So you two are now officially developing this movie and you are on this project together." When they were given the go-ahead to, officially go into production of the movie, Chris and Dean agreed to have a smaller budget and crew and to use less time to make the movie, as well as committing to do much of the development themselves, including writing, storyboarding, and being really interactive and hands-on in making the movie. After working for so long on Mulan, they were excited to steer away from a big epic story with hundreds of characters on screen and develop this story, which was mostly on their own without a lot of input from upper management. And that was kind of unusual for a Disney animated film at the time, because, you know, usually they'd have a big group working on the story and fleshing it out. But this was mostly Chris and Dean with a couple of key artists working together to create this story.
I'm guessing like the main reason behind that is because they had a low budget because their animation department wasn't doing great around that time.
You know what? I didn't know that that was the reason. I didn't actually read that either.
I'm just like, I would have to assume that that's the reason, because, you know, after Tarzan, they were not producing a ton of hits, you know,
right.
Like mega hits, like how they were.
Yeah. Mulan, I think, did pretty well.
Right.
I'm not
Mulan
sure what
the
reasons were.
98. Mulan did great, but I'm just like, I know, yeah, like they had other things in the works that were struggling with. So I was just curious if that was why.
I don't know if they just needed a palate cleanser after Mulan, or they were just looking to have a smaller budget for the next film.
Yeah.
But whatever the reason, they decided to make sort of a smaller original story. And I think they were worried about the risk they were taking with a smaller original story. So they were like, okay, we're going to give
you
a smaller crew.
Let's not pour a ton into this. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. For the film setting, Chris and Dean decided on a rural place, Kansas specifically, with a young boy as the protagonist. But Chris had vacationed in Hawaii a few times and actually had a map of Hawaii on his wall. And when he was thinking about the story, he looked up at the map and thought, that might actually be a good setting for the movie. He was specifically looking at the island of Kauai because it still had a small town, rural feel, but with a rich culture and a lot of interesting history behind it. Now, before I continue talking about Hawaii, as our regular listeners know, we pull from a variety of sources for our research, and we include as many of those sources as possible in our show notes. But a lot of my information comes from one particular source that was fantastic for my research, and it was a video that Jess actually found on YouTube called The Story Room, The Making of Lilo and Stitch. And it's an hour and a half long documentary that was originally included on the Lilo and Stitch 2-disc Big Wave Edition DVD. And I highly recommend it for anyone interested in the making of this movie. And we will include a link in our show notes.
Yeah, and it was really cool because I'm a big Lilo and Stitch fan, but I wasn't aware of that until recently, because you kind of would have had to have had that DVD that came out close to its initial release to kind of know about it.
Yes, as big of a fan as I was of Lilo and Stitch, I didn't actually know much about the making of it. And that documentary was so helpful because it had so much footage of them doing research and working. So we would highly recommend it. Going back to Hawaii. So when they decided to set the movie in Hawaii, they actually got teased by some of their coworkers at Disney because they were like, oh, you're trying to get a nice vacation out of it? Oh, you're going to Hawaii, huh?
Trip. Yeah. I mean, if I was told I would have to do a research trip just like, you know, to Kansas, and no offense to Kansas, but you know, like, I'd probably be like, oh, can we go somewhere that's like more like... like, you know, more like of a typical vacation spot, if we can.
Right. Well, they did get to go on a research trip to the island, but it wasn't just for funsies. It turned out to be a very important move because an element of Hawaiian culture became the main theme of the movie. That theme was, of course, ohana, or family. Dean said the story was always going to be about a dysfunctional family and what happens when a destructive force comes into the picture and is affected by the idea of family. But then when Chris and Dean went to Hawaii, they learned about ohana. Dean said, "We were exposed to the idea of ohana, and that's something that the Hawaiian people carry around with them. It's alive and present, and it's this all-embodying philosophy that if you live several islands away, you're as much my brother and sister as my immediate brother and sister. We're all together, and we count upon each other in times of crisis." It was a really neat idea because it opened up the doors to the idea of the unconventional family as we know it, and that an alien could be part of a family unit. So I thought that was great that they were inspired by ohana and how you can make your own family.
I just can't imagine what I mean, obviously it would have been a similar movie, but like I can't imagine how different the impact of the movie and the longevity of the movie would have been if it weren't for the Ohana aspect, because I
Right.
know to me that's what really spoke to me, like me not having like a typical family dynamic growing up. That's what really spoke to me about this movie. And Ohana, you know, isn't necessarily just your family, it's everyone who feels like family to you. And I'm just like, I don't know if the movie would have had the impact it did if it weren't for the Ohana aspect of it. So that's
Yeah,
a
for
really good move
sure.
that they made it take place in Hawaii and incorporate Hawaiian culture like that.
Yeah, that's the heart of the movie, really. And so they got that rural setting that they wanted because Kauai is, you know, its own place. It's a little more rural and isolated, but it has this rich, beautiful history that they were able to draw on for the movie. So now, with the story more solidified, before the film could go into production, it obviously needed a producer. Clark Spencer, who is now the president of Walt Disney Animation Studios, was the senior vice president of finance and operation at the animation studio in Paris at the time. According to Spencer, he said that Dean had suggested him becoming producer of the film because he seemed like a pretty nice guy. And so Spencer was brought to Florida to produce Lilo and Stitch. Spencer, for his part, was looking forward to shifting away from finance and becoming more of a general manager and having a producing role. And the three guys had a reportedly very compatible working relationship. So it was time to head into production of the film that Chris and Dean had been working so hard on developing, and they didn't want to have to worry about making some sort of technological advancement in the film in terms of animation, since that wouldn't necessarily serve the story. And like we said, they also had a smaller budget and shorter time frame. So they drew inspiration from movies like Dumbo and Bambi that had a simpler storybook visual style. And then they floated the idea of using watercolor for the backgrounds. Now, that hadn't been used at the studio since the early 1940s. So back then, when gouache paints became more widely mass-produced and readily available, the studio stepped away from using watercolors because watercolors were more challenging to paint with. So the idea of using watercolors was not easily embraced by the animators, who would basically have to retrain themselves on how to use the paint.
I thought it was interesting when Roy E. Disney mentioned in the documentary, who, you know, was a big part of Walt Disney Animation during this time that Lilo and Stitch was made. He was saying too that with watercolor, with the multi-plane camera system and them actually putting the paintings, you know, into the multi-plane camera system, sometimes the watercolor, it would get like stuck. Like some of the colors would lift off and get stuck. But now with them putting the animation, you know, into a computer versus a multi-plane camera, they didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, so it was an easier possibility for the contemporary animation studio, but it also wasn't because they weren't using that technique anymore. But they did side-by-side tests of the backgrounds using both gouache and using watercolors, and hands down, watercolors were the favorite because they best captured the beautiful colors of Hawaii and had the look Chris and Dean were going for. And several of the artists mentioned that it kind of had a stained glass quality too because of the translucence and how the colors would blend together. So it just overall had the look that they wanted to get. So to get tips on how to best use watercolors for the film, the art director on Lilo and Stitch, Rick Sluter, actually met with Maurice Noble, who was one of the background painters on Snow White back in the 1930s. He asked him all about the paints they use, the paper, and his techniques. And then the animators got to work on practicing their watercolor techniques and retraining themselves to paint in that style. The film's background supervisor, Robert A. Stanton, was talking about this in the documentary. He said that while they were on their research trip in Hawaii, the artists were hanging out and looking at the scenery and painting what they were seeing and, you know, basically staying in one place and practicing their watercolors while Chris and Dean were off talking to the people in Hawaii and having a little adventures. And it was kind of like he was like, we were stuck at home while they were off having fun. But the work definitely paid off because I think the watercolors look gorgeous in the movie and really gave it a unique look compared to other animated movies of the time.
Yeah, for sure. And it's such a It just seems like such a specifically like Hawaiian style. Like I've been to Hawaii a couple times, and if you, I remember like going to Hawaii close to the time period Lilo and Stitch came out. And then when I was in Hawaii, I remember like looking at a kid's book, and they used a lot of watercolors and similar color palette that's in the movie. So I'm like, okay, this is definitely in a lot of like Hawaiian paintings and books, like that kind of style and color palette.
It's really beautiful, and I think it, like you said, it captures that Hawaiian look so well. So when it comes to the characters, most of the designs were inspired by Chris Sanders' art style. Byron Howard, who was a supervising animator on the film, said that Chris didn't seem to think he had a certain style of drawing since that was the way he'd drawn since he was a kid, but he definitely did, and the animators needed to really analyze his way of drawing and break it down so that it could be replicated during the animation process. So, like, how did Chris draw fabric? How did Chris draw, the human anatomy? Like, they had to sort of look at his way of drawing and create the characters in that style. And of course, the most important characters to design on the film were Lilo and Stitch. Chris's first illustrations of Stitch had him shown with a bit of a greenish color, but they ended up thinking that looked a little too over the top, so they pushed the color in a more grayish direction. Then Dean noticed that some of the dogs in Lady and the Tramp had a sort of slate blue color, so then they started shifting Stitch's color to more of a blue-gray, and then they ended up with Stitch's blue shade. At that point, Stitch looked kind of like, as Dean described it, a dog-like koala thing. Stitch's look started to evolve alongside his behavior. When they came up with the idea that he would be trying to act like a dog to fit in, his appearance became a bit more dog-like, but everyone except Lilo is creeped out by him and treat him more like a cryptid creature than a dog. Dean and Chris had asked supervising animator Alex Kupershmidt to give Stitch lots of weird movements. Dean said, "The idea with Stitch is that he can either look really cute or really upsetting. He always walks that line, and we thought with his movement it should be the same way." So he had lots of unexpected insect-like movements that are cool and are just repulsive.
Oh my
I thought that was
gosh.
funny that they didn't want
He
him
can
to be
either be really
too
cute or really upsetting.
right. Like, Stitch is obviously super cute, but they didn't want him to be too cute. They wanted a part of him to be just a little
Right,
gross,
because
a
they need
little
the adults in the
unsettling.
movie to be like,
What is that thing? Lilo was also a bit of a challenge because Chris's drawings for the human characters were very rounded and stylistic. Christine Lawrence Finney, who was the co-head of cleanup animation at the time, said her department's job was to make sure all of the characters were on model and on style, and she called Chris's drawing style elusive. So she seemed to find it a bit challenging. She talked about how Mickey Mouse is drawn and that he's very rounded, so it's very easy to get off model if it's not drawn right. And we've seen that when a, like
We do Animation
knockoff
Academy
artists.
at California Adventure,
Yeah, exactly. Or when
he
knockoff
just makes
artists
the
try to make a
ears the
Mickey.
slightly wrong size and he doesn't look like a
He
mouse. He looks like a
doesn't look
chipmunk
right.
or something.
Yeah, he doesn't look right. She said with more angular characters, the artists have anchor points that they can rely on to stay on model, but most of the characters in Lilo and Stitch didn't have those qualities, so it was their challenge to make the characters look consistent throughout the movie with Chris Sanders' kind of roundish drawing style. Now, there was a really interesting story that happened during the making of the movie, and it's sad, but it also was a big part of the production process, so I think it's important to mention. As I said before, the budget for the movie was smaller, but there was one scene that Chris and Dean knew was going to be an important climactic moment in the film and would require a large part of their budget. So they pushed it to get made early so they knew they would have it nailed down. In one of the later parts of the movie, Captain Gantu, who has been sent to take Stitch back home, captures Stitch and accidentally scoops up Lilo as well. Stitch manages to escape, but Lilo is still stuck inside a part of the ship. So Stitch sets out on a rescue mission to save her, and in the first version of the scene, steals a Boeing 747 plane with only his fellow alien Plinkly on board to chase down the ship. Test audiences would actually erupt into cheers as the plane would burst through the clouds in pursuit of the spaceship, and they saw that Stitch was piloting the plane. The chase went through the city with the two crafts navigating between tall buildings, causing damage here and there, and even knocking off the top of a shirtless guy's ice cream cone.
Oh, I feel so bad that he never gets his ice
His
cream in
poor
the
ice cream.
movie.
So even though Chris and Dean kept arguing about how the plane should be introduced in the story, they both loved the scene and the studio was really proud of how it turned out. But then, during production of the film, the terror attacks of September 11th, 2001 happened, which I'm sure, as everyone remembers, involved the hijacking of passenger planes. So after absorbing the horrible news, everyone at Disney just instinctively knew the scene with the airplane had to be changed, and they began working on it as soon as they could. The higher-ups at Disney talked to the studios, and when they found out the animators were already reworking the scenes, they were relieved and gave them the go-ahead to keep moving forward with the changes. And in the documentary, they said there was no talk of budget or what it would take to make it happen. They just had permission to do what they needed to do under the, really awful circumstances. They then remembered when they were reworking the story that the alien characters of Jumba and Pleakley, who were also sent to capture Stitch and take him back into space, had a spaceship in hiding that they could use to rescue Lilo. So the story changed to Stitch using that ship to rescue her. And instead of flying through the city, they would instead fly through Kauai's beautiful mountain canyons. And happily, they were still able to get the gag in with one of the spaceship's wings knocking off the top of that shirtless guy's ice cream cone. And if you want to see a side-by-side of those two scenes together, Jess, again, my YouTube sleuth, she found this great video that shows the scenes side by side, and we will put a link in our show notes. And I think that was a really good choice for them to change it because even I, who, it's been so long since 2001, but even I watching the scene with the plane, it made
It
my
was so
palms sweat.
similar. Yeah, it was too similar.
It actually gave me anxiety. And so even all these years later, just having watched it at the time, so I think it was a really good choice for them to change
And
it.
I thought it was interesting when you watched the side by side of the original version with the plane and then the version that's in the movie with the spaceship. You could tell that they did salvage a little bit of the budget in that the characters' movements, like Stitch and Jumba, the things they're doing, it's pretty much the exact same motion. So it looked like they were able to repurpose the character animation, but then the setting seemed to be the only change.
Yeah, they changed a lot of the backgrounds and a couple of things in the main animation. But yeah, they were able to salvage a lot of it, which was really, really good for them. One of the funny and unusual things about this movie is that Stitch was actually voiced by Chris Sanders himself. Directors and writers of Disney's animated films have occasionally voiced smaller characters, but it was pretty unusual for the director and writer to voice a lead character. Since Stitch doesn't start out speaking English and only uses alien language or noises to communicate, Chris and Dean kind of felt awkward about bringing in a professional actor just to make weird noises for the scratch or rough versions of the film. Chris said he used to do a particular funny voice to annoy his coworkers, and he used that voice for Stitch. Well, it ended up sticking, and they decided to keep him as the voice of Stitch, which I personally think was a wise decision because Stitch's voice is adorable. I love Stitch's voice. Later on, Chris actually ended up leaving Disney, but he continued to come back and do Stitch's voice for more projects. Now, when it came to Lilo, the directors were looking for a little girl who could bring an offbeat quality to the character since they had written her as being quirky and even a bit macabre. Jess, I could never figure out how the lead actress's name is pronounced. Is it DeVay? I think it's DeVay.
I think so, but I'm honestly not 100% sure.
So my
But I
apologies to
always just say
her.
debate.
I looked at several videos and I couldn't come up with a for sure definite how to pronounce her name. So I'm just going to say DeVay. And she was cast as Lilo because she had what Lilo's supervising animator, Andreas Deja, described as a haunted quality. Chris said that when she auditioned, she would give a really amazing emotional line reading and then sit back quietly. And when they would compliment her, she would just say, thanks, which I could totally.
That's hilarious that they say that she has a haunting quality, because I feel like this is a fun fact a lot of people may know, but that same actress is Samara in
In the
The
Ring, yes, a very scary character. So she used that haunted quality in full effect when she went on to play that character. But for Lilo and Stitch, she had the sweetness mixed with sadness, mixed with sass that the filmmakers were looking for. Tia Carrere, who is Hawaiian, was cast as Nani, Lilo's older sister and guardian. And up to that point, she was known for movies like Wayne's World and True Lies. And as a native Hawaiian, Tia brought an authenticity to her role and even helped with the dialogue by introducing Hawaiian phrases and philosophies to the team. She also insisted on the casting of Jason Scott Lee, an actor of Hawaiian and Chinese descent, to play her friend David in the film. Now, David Ogden Steers, a highly respected and prolific actor who had also voiced Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast, was cast as Jumba. And Jumba had this kind of funny sort of pseudo-Russian accent that they gave him. So David Ogden Steers was chosen to be able to do this sort of very grounded, strong alien voice, but also with this very interesting accent. Kevin MacDonald, a comedic actor who had many credits but was best known for the Canadian sketch comedy show The Kids in the Hall, played Pleakley. And I am a huge Kids in the Hall fan, so that was fun casting for me. I really liked hearing Kevin MacDonald do that character. And Cobra Bubbles, the social worker who was assigned to check in on Lilo, was played by Ving Rhames. The funny thing about this character is that he was originally conceived as being kind of a nervous, skinny white guy, but when they decided they needed the character to be a stronger, more grounded presence in order for Lilo to actually listen to him, they cast Ving Rhames and reworked the whole visual style of Cobra Bubbles, which was a really fun choice. You don't generally envision a social worker to be a big tough guy, so that was smart of them to play against stereotype with the character.
And I'm always very fascinated with Cobra Bubbles. And I have said this on Twitter before, but I want a Disney Plus series that's his origin story of when he worked for the CIA. Like, I want his
Oh my
backstory.
gosh, yes, that would be
I want
so
it so
fun.
bad.
That would be so fun because I love any like alien stories. Like E.T. is one of my favorite characters of all time. That would be so fun to have Cobra Bubbles and his former days before he became a social worker, his days as a CIA agent and dealing with aliens visiting Earth. That would be so much fun. So the music. Actually, originally Chris and Dean didn't think it would be an important part of the film, but it ended up being a really important and touching part. So I'm kind of talking off cuff because I wasn't able to write down my notes for this, but Alan Silvestri was the composer for the movie, and he had composed many film scores before that. And Chris and Dean actually were using his soundtracks while they were planning out the story. Like they would use his movie soundtracks as, you know, background music. And so they were like, please, Alan Silvestri, he's our first, second, and third choice. Let's get him to do the music. So he came in to do the orchestral score. And then Elvis Presley was also a big part of the movie. Elvis actually filmed several, or I don't remember how many movies, but Elvis actually filmed a couple of movies in Hawaii. And Chris Sanders is a big fan of Elvis. So they actually had to get special permission from his estate to not only use the music in the movie, but to use his image and to slightly change the lyrics to one of the songs. But they got permission to do everything that they needed to do in the movie. And Lilo is a big fan of Elvis. So that played an important role in the movie. And Stitch even dresses up as him and impersonates him. And then finally, one of the best parts of the soundtrack, or I would say maybe the best part in my opinion, is the children's choir. Let me look up the name really quick if that's okay, Jess.
Yeah, I also wanted to interject because I know the documentary didn't really talk about Jason Scott Lee, who plays David, his casting, but I just wanted to share like how we shared about Debbie playing Davi. Playing Samara in the ring. I mean, Jason Scott Lee has been in many, many things, but a cameo that I always find fun is that in Back to the Future 2, Griff, you know, who's the grandson of Biff Tanner in Back to the Future 2, Jason Scott Lee, who plays David, is the friend of Griff who goes, "Unless you got power."
That's fantastic. Unless you
I
got
don't know why I really
power.
like that he's randomly that friend who says that. I also like Back to the Future trilogy are some of my favorite movies of all time. So,
I
and
mean,
so is Lilo and Stitch. So I like the tie-in.
well, you know, here's another tie-in. Alan Silvestri composed the music for the Back to the Future movies.
Oh
So,
my
yeah, there's
gosh.
it all comes together.
Yeah, in the great circle of Lilo and
In
Stitch.
the great circle of Lilo and Stitch. So the Kamehameha School's children's chorus did a couple of the songs on the soundtrack, like Hawaiian Roller Coaster Ride.
There's no place I'd rather be.
It was actually a school choir. It started out as just kind of a casual during recess children's choir as part of the school. And then, you know, they started gaining more popularity and then it became an audition only children's choir. And so they were brought in to record some music. And obviously everyone was really touched and excited about their involvement. They really loved hearing the kids. And when the children were recording, the parents, of course, were along too, and they were in a separate room while the children were recording. And then they said, hey, why don't we bring the parents in to come watch the children for one of these takes? So they brought the parents in. They were showing like rough cuts of the animation that the children would be singing over it. And a lot of the parents got teary-eyed just hearing their children sing and knowing that, you know, their culture was going to be up on this big Disney movie. It was just a really moving moment for many of them. And the filmmakers kind of felt like they became a part of these children's families and they had sort of become part of theirs. They actually went to Hawaii to do a special screening for the children's chorus because they wanted to make sure that the children got to see the movie.
I mean,
movie,
they're a big part of it.
They are a big part of it, and they lend so much authenticity and sweetness to the movie, to the soundtrack, and they made sure to give them this special screening for them and their families all in their own. And the kids, of course, loved it, and it was a really moving experience for all of them. So that's where I'm ending my segment. And Jess, do you want to take us into the release of the movie?
Yes, and I'm going to start us off with sound clips.
But sound clips.
So I'm going to be talking about first the release and the world premiere. And of course, leading up to that, there was some marketing. And for, you know, those who were big Disney fans during this time period, I feel like whether you remember it off the top of your head or if what I'm about to say is going to unlock a memory, I mean, you guys remember the commercials where they are playing Disney Renaissance movies like Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King, and Stitch like crashes the movie. And then the characters are like, get your own movie. But I remember like thinking that was like such a brilliant like I just thought like, oh my God, this is so cool. And now I'm like, that was great marketing. But also like there's some things I'm watching it now and I'm like, well, I'll play the Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin one for you guys.
Yes, please.
Can you hear it okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so Belle and Beast are dancing. As old as time. The iconic ballroom scene, of course. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, Stitch is on the ceiling. As it can be. What is he gonna do? Oh, he's climbing on the chandelier. Oh, it's gonna fall.
Oh. And he breaks the chandelier.
I'll be in my room. Get your own movie.
His name is Stitch.
Okay, so that's the... They all have the same... They all lead to the same thing, but they all have a different beginning. And then here's the... Let me go to the Aladdin one. But they all have a different beginning. All right, Stitch is about to pull up next to them in his... Basic. Sorry, he's like hitting on Jasmine right now. And Jasmine gets in his spaceship and flies away.
Hey, get your own movie. His name is
And the reason I dislike this is because the Lion King version, Rafiki, instead of holding up baby Simba in the Circle of Life, he holds up Stitch. Uh-huh. And all the animals are like, wah!
What is
but I'm
that?
Just like, really? I'm like, this isn't Stitch. This isn't the Stitch character. Why did they have to have him hitting on the princesses and catcalling them? I hate it. Anyway, I didn't hate it as a kid, but now as a feminist adult, it makes me annoyed.
I know. Well, they actually said in the documentary that people at the time really seemed to enjoy them.
I loved them when they came out. It was also the early 2000s. They would never do that now. They would never do a commercial like that now.
No. In retrospect, you know, we've encountered this a lot on this podcast. In retrospect,
watch 90s things and we're like, that's sexist.
We're definitely taken aback by some of them as adult women, but yeah.
That was some strong marketing at the time. It was effective.
Yes.
So the world premiere of Lilo and Stitch, they had a huge inflatable Stitch above the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood, which I mentioned earlier that Disney owns. And it seems to be the same inflatable Stitch that they would use from place to place for various marketing things, whether it be at Disneyland or Magic Kingdom or Downtown
Maybe
Disney.
Maybe that was the one that made me yell, Mommy. That inflatable Stitch was the one.
Yeah, like maybe they had a couple of them, but I'm sure they didn't have like a ton of them because it's pretty big.
Right,
it has to be
it's
expensive.
Really big.
I'm sure it traveled around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the premiere in Hollywood, they had meet and greet characters of Lilo as well as Stitch dressed as Elvis, which I just want to interject because I feel like I can't cover Lilo and Stitch without saying this disclaimer. The Elvis stuff was so cute to me as a kid, and they have so much Stitch merch even nowadays where he's dressed as Elvis. Mm-hmm. And I love Stitch, but I'm like, I can't buy this. Like, I wish he wasn't so much a part of the movie because, you know, Elvis isn't a great person. So I'm just like, you know, he's very problematic. And so I'm like, why does he have to be so associated with Stitch? I don't like it.
I mean, I think Jess is referring to specifically like the way that he used black music.
Yes.
To gain popularity. And then the original creators, you know, didn't get the same popularity or credit for their song. So I think that's something that is a problem for many of us, even though, you know, Elvis is a pioneer of rock and roll. He's also working off of a lot of taken music.
Yeah, so it's very problematic.
Hopefully we won't get Elvis fans like trashing us. But still, it's a part of it.
Yeah, it's just something I have to acknowledge this because I get why they used Elvis because Elvis was very associated with Hawaiian culture in the 50s. So I get why they chose it, but I don't think they would have chosen him today because now we are more aware and more caring of this knowledge we have about the history of his music. So I'm just like, I wish there wasn't so much merch with Stitch dressed as him because I don't want to buy it.
I agree.
Anyway, sorry, I had to have my...
I don't mind. I'm happy to have that.
Polynesian dancers were also at the pre-show, and there was also a premiere in Honolulu, which I thought was cool, since you don't really ever hear about movie premieres happening in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I think the only other time in recent years I heard about that happening was with, like, Jumanji, because they did a lot of filming there or something. But anyway, the new Jumanji. And at the Hawaiian premiere, there was a Lilo hula dancing ice sculpture and a sculpture of Stitch playing the ukulele.
Aww.
And there was, of course, also a premiere in Graceland, because of the tie-in with Elvis and his estate being based there. But I just thought it was interesting that there were three U.S. premieres, because typically there's like the Hollywood one, maybe a New York one, and then the others are going to be in different countries. But there was like just three in the U.S.
Yeah.
Let's talk about its official release to the public. So it opened on June 16th, 2002. Oh my gosh, literally next year will be its 20th anniversary.
Yes.
I want an explosion of merch. There already kind of is, but I want more, bigger. On its first weekend, it was in second place at the box office, making $35.3 million opening weekend, which just put it $500,000 behind Minority Report. And even though it was a big success, it never made number one during its run. It was always like just behind these other big releases happening. But it did end up making $273.1 million globally with 25 million tickets sold. And the film had a budget of $80 million. So obviously, like, it made its money back and it did great.
And then some,
Yeah, and, you know, it may not sound incredibly significant in terms of many Disney animated films we have today, like Frozen, and obviously it wasn't as big as like Lion King or Beauty and the Beast in terms of what it made, but this was very significant for the studios at this time, since in the early 2000s, Disney was not having luck producing critical or box office hits. So this success and popularity, although maybe not as big as the early Disney Renaissance film, was still a huge win for Walt Disney Animation at this time. And boy, were they going to take advantage of that win. And have,
as listeners, if you ever hear a boom sound on the audio, it is just... I love it. I always know when you're really passionate about what you're saying, because I always hear those
It's me smacking my desk.
I always hear those little booms when I'm editing. I'm like, oh, Jess was feeling very passionate about the topic. She was smacking her hand on the desk.
I didn't even realize that until you said that just now that I did that. Now I'm going to have to pay more attention.
It's very cute.
Overall, it was a critically acclaimed movie, having pretty positive ratings, and an 86% certified fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Now, for those of you who maybe are Patreon members, and we'll get a little more into that as we sign off in the episode, but in our Patreon exclusive episodes, a couple times I've done dramatic monologue readings of critic reviews, and it's one of my favorite things to do. And I'm going to do one today written by Roger Ebert of Siskel and Ebert.
Oh, I'm so excited.
June 21st, 2002. Hang on. Drink.
Everyone get ready. Jess needs to get her water. She needs to get into character.
Okay. Wow, I better live up to this hype. All right. Here's his review. Only a week ago, I deplored the wretched Scooby-Doo as a blight on this nation's theaters. My fellow critics agreed. Checking the websites that monitor reviews, I find that at RottenTomatoes.com, the movie scored a 26, a Metacritic a 27, passing grade is 60. The American public effortlessly shrugged off this warning cry and raced to the box office to throw away $54 million. Now, here comes a truly inspired animated feature named Lilo and Stitch.
Aww.
How will it do? It's one of the most charming feature-length cartoons of recent years. Funny, sassy, startling, original, and six songs by Elvis. It doesn't get sick. It does. It makes it sound like they were original songs written for the movie. The way he worded it. Anyway. It doesn't get sickeningly sweet at the end. It has as much stuff in it for the grown-ups as for kids, and it has a bright offbeat look to it. Now, if Scooby-Doo grossed $54 million in its first weekend, then if there is any justice in this world, Lilo and Stitch should gross $200 million. But there is no justice.
Oh.
There is no justice. There is only herd instinct. On Monday, a man on an elevator asked me what I thought about Scooby-Doo. I said, it's a very bad movie. My kids want to see it, he said. Yes, I said, because they've heard of nothing else all week. But there is a much, much better animated family film opening this weekend, that named Lilo and Stitch, that your kids are sure to like much more than Scooby-Doo. And you'll enjoy it too. Take my word, I do this for a living. Take the kids to Lilo and Stitch. I could see from the man's eyes that he was rejecting my advice. Oh, how could I possibly be right when $54 million said I was wrong? How could human taste be a better barometer of movie quality than the success of a marketing campaign? Prediction? This weekend, more parents and their children will dutifully file into the idiotic wasteland of Scooby-Doo than see the inspired delights of Lilo and Stitch. That would be a sham. Lilo and Stitch, produced by the same Disney team that made Mulan, is a toothy fantasy about an alien monster that accidentally finds itself adopted as the pet of a little girl in Hawaii. The creature, named Stitch, was produced by an illegal genetic mutation and is so horrifyingly hostile that it's been locked up by its inventors. It escapes to Earth, is mistaken for a very strange dog, and adopted by Lilo, who essentially uses her innocence and the Aloha spirit to confuse and even civilize the creature. This all takes place against a cheerful background of pop culture references, including scenes spoofing Men in Black, Jaws, and Godzilla. I mean, Stitch even first builds a model of San Francisco, then destroys it. And the film firmly positions itself in Hawaii, both the Hawaii of Tourist Kitsch and the Hawaii of the Aloha Spirit, and the plot revolves around concepts of ohana, or family, since Lilo is being raised by her big sister Nani, who's disorganized and not always a perfect substitute mom, and is up against a disapproving social worker named Cobra Bubbles. And then, you know, skips, goes more into the plot, and finishes off with Lilo and Stitch, of course, had trouble communicating, since Lilo is very young and Stitch speaks no English, but the alien, who's a quick study, picks up some words and, more important, some concepts that challenge its existence as a destructive being. Lilo and Nani are learning too how to be family and take care of each other, but the movie doesn't get all soppy at the end and is surprisingly unsentimental for a Disney animated feature. It keeps its edge and its comic zest all the way through. Although it arrives relatively unheralded, it is a jewel. 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? All of that and 3.5 stars. You've got to be kidding me.
That was my favorite part. Oh, that's my favorite part. He's being so dramatic about it and talking about, he used this opportunity as a platform to talk more about how he hated Scooby-Doo. I'm sure he already wrote a review for Scooby-Doo, but was like, I have more to say. This is my time. And I love how he's like, it's a jewel. 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars. I am baffled. Okay. so many things. First of all, this review is way more, like you said, way more of a diss on Scooby-Doo than about Lilo and Stitch. Like, this is about Scooby-Doo. This is a second review for Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, I'm assuming he did a first one, which, I better look up the first one. That would be a fun read.
I'm glad he loved Lilo and Stitch, though.
He didn't. I'm confused if he did or not, because he gave it 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars after all of that. I'm so confused. But anyway, I really enjoyed that reading. That was very, very good.
$54 million to the pathetic wasteland that was Scooby-Doo.
So dramatic.
I love how he's like, but there is no justice. There is no justice. Like, so dramatic.
I had no idea this review existed. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Because like, some are just like typical. I'm like, I gotta find one that's dramatic, and I try my best to do that.
Most are probably normal reviews all about
Most were normal. This was the one that I found that I was, because most of them were good, and so I'm just like, this one is also good, but he disses good.
He talks crap about Scooby-Doo.
I know. I just love that there is no justice.
There is no justice.
So let's talk about what came after the release.
Right. Let's go.
Its success warranted a slew of animated sequels and series. First, in 2003, a direct-to-video sequel, Stitch, the movie, where we first meet Angel, you know, the little pink alien who looks very similar to Stitch. You probably see her on lots of merch and plushies. Mm-hmm. And Stitch, the movie, also doubled as a pilot and backstory for Lilo and Stitch, the series. One of my faves. Turkey Bawaba! Ow! The series had a 65-episode run from 2003 to 2006. And I also find it fascinating, too, that nowadays, like, the fan culture for Stitch is bigger than ever, I would say. And Angel is on so much of the merchandise, I would say, almost as equally as Stitch. Like, Stitch a little bit more, but, like, it's pretty on par. And it's just so interesting because Angel originated from a direct-to-video sequel. And I'm like, I don't know of any other characters that are on merchandise today, like, in the parks and just at box lunch or whatever, that came from a Disney direct-to-video sequel. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that are so significant on all the merchandise. Yeah.
Yeah. In 2005, there was a direct-to-home sequel, Lilo and Stitch 2, Stitch Has a Glitch, and in 2006, a made-for-TV movie, Leroy and Stitch, and there's another movie that you may have heard about that's in the talks of happening, or it is happening. We don't know too much about it yet. That's kind of has a divided opinion about it amongst fans, but there's going to be a live action adaptation of Lilo and Stitch that's being made for our Disney Plus.
I saw that and I was like, wait, is this a joke or is
no,
this
it's
like,
real.
Do I need, I know I figured out it was real, but I was like, should I look it up on Snopes? Like this doesn't seem like, this doesn't seem real, but yeah. Yeah, I guess it's in pre-production.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I usually like what Disney makes, so I'm not like, oh, this is going to be the worst thing ever. I just am not in that mindset when it comes to Disney, but
yeah,
but I am like, oh, this is kind of an odd choice because it was already right. a successful movie, and it, I don't know, it just strikes me as odd.
It's hard to picture because I'm not anti live action remakes. I actually enjoy quite a lot of them. And even if I don't enjoy them, I'm not a person where it affects my feelings towards the original at all.
No, you can watch both.
Don't like it.
It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if I'm like, oh, I didn't like that, I could still enjoy the original. It doesn't ruin it for me. And, you know, I was unsure about if I'd like Lady and the Tramp that was made for Disney Plus, but I really, mm-hmm. really liked it. So I'm not saying I'm like, oh, I hate that they're doing this. Like, I'm definitely going to watch it, and I'm excited that there's going to be more Lilo and Stitch. But I guess I'm just like, for me personally, like, The Lion King, I'm just like, it was all kind of animated, so I don't really know mm-hmm. what the point of that was. And then so for Lilo and Stitch, I'm like, Stitch would obviously be animated, and I'm just like, do we need that? But also, it's an interesting thing because, like I mentioned, there was an animated series. There's so many direct-to-video sequels. So it's not like it's a sacred movie that's been untouched right. since its perfect ending. They've expanded upon the story yeah. many times after the perfect ending. So it's not like that hasn't already been dived into to an extreme.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting. But it does make me feel better to know that Chris Saunders will be returning as the voice of Stitch.
I think where they can make it or break it is the design of Stitch because,
yeah.
you know, I'm assuming if it's going to be fully live action, it'll be live actors
yeah.
and Stitch will be one of the main things that would be animated. So
and
that would be.
I can't picture how, because like I feel like they would have to make him look almost exactly the same, but then that would be yeah. too cartoony, but I like don't want him to look different. I don't know.
I know. He's so yeah. cute. Like,
I don't know what they would do.
I think the only thing I'm worried about is like, not worried about, but the only thing that I'm interested in seeing, oh, what are they going to do with that, is this design of Stitch. I think that's going to kind of make it yeah. or break it. So we'll yeah. see. Yeah.
Now, also, speaking to how Disney wanted to take advantage of the success of Lilo and Stitch and, you know, how much people love Stitch, mm-hmm. is his occurrence in the theme parks. He has probably among the most occurrences in a theme park compared to many other characters. He's had so much based on him in the theme parks across the world. It's just interesting that Stitch is a pretty uniquely evergreen character, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not like they just used him only when the movie first came out. Like, he's still pretty present in the parks now, but he's like not lumped into a group like how Pooh and Friends are, or yes. Mickey and Friends, or Disney Princesses. He's just like his own powerhouse, and I love that
yeah.
for him. Great
you
for
know,
him.
A couple of times we did the Paradise Pier character breakfast mm-hmm. for my daughter's birthdays. My parents wanted to take her there a couple years in a row. And it was like Mickey and Minnie and Donald and Daisy and Stitch. Like yeah. we're the meet and greet characters. It's so funny that he's kind of in a category all his own, but he can appear anywhere with anyone, basically. Maybe not yeah. the princesses, but you know,
yeah.
with any of the regular characters, he can be there too.
I love how you say that he maybe not appear with the princesses, but I'm about to talk about when he did, and it didn't work.
Yes, do it.
So, like I said, there's been lots of attractions and just restaurants or occurrences in the park with Stitch, but probably the most notorious is the biggest attraction of them all, Stitch's Great Escape at Magic Kingdom in Walt Disney World. Mm-hmm. I would say this ride is across the board mostly hated by everyone. Even me, who loves Stitch, I uh-huh. did not like this attraction.
I didn't go on it, so I can't say, but
yeah,
I've only heard negative things.
It closed in 2018, and people are like, bye, we don't miss it. So let me talk about it, if you're unfamiliar. So a big reason from the get-go that this attraction was disliked by parkgoers is because it was replaced by, I don't want to say a favorite among like guests overall, because there was a lot of guests who were very upset by this ride, but it had like mm-hmm. a fan, like an intense like Disney AP like fan culture around extraterrestrial alien encounter. I never rode because I didn't go to Disney during the time period it was there, but I wouldn't have ridden it anyway because aliens terrify me. And also you're constrained.
Except Stitch.
And you, yeah, except Stitch. But you would have been constrained and the alien, claustrophobia, aliens too much.
Yes, yeah,
I wouldn't have gone on it. But it closed because it was ultimately deemed too scary and intense for a family-friendly park.
And no disrespect to the Imagineers who worked on this ride, if any of them hear this, like, I imagine it must be really hard to rework a ride that already exists into a totally different ride. So, you know, I guess they had to do that with Stitch's Great Escape.
Yeah, and here's the thing, like, and I'll get a little bit more into it in a sec, but, like, the animatronic was great. Like, the animatronic was great, but, like, there's a lot of things about it that were wrong, which I'll talk about. And, again, like, we love you, Imagineers. It's not your fault, but they had such a small budget to work with.
Yeah.
And they couldn't really transform much of the showroom that existed. So Stitch's Great Escape would open November 16th, 2004, with the original closing of Extraterrestrial being in October of 2003. And the announcement that Extraterrestrial was going to close gave guests 2 days' notice. So people were pretty upset about that.
Oh, whoa.
They had 2 days' notice that
that's quick.
The attraction was closing, and then it closed. The Imagineers had a very tight budget, so that meant that the original attraction wouldn't be gutted too much. It was the same showroom layout. It was like a theater in the round layout, and the same shoulder bars. It was like over your head shoulder bars, like as if you were going on a roller coaster that goes upside down. So it was those kind of shoulder bars that are on you, and they still use those. And for Extraterrestrial, there's like a big glass tube in the center of the room that would have the terrifying alien animatronic. This would be the same layout, but it would be Stitch dressed in his alien form in the beginning of the movie when the security guards from the Galactic Federation have him in custody.
Right.
So it was like that. The plot of the attraction of Stitch's Great Escape was notoriously hard to follow during the show. The basic plot point is that we're supposed to be guards of the Galactic Federation guarding Stitch so that he doesn't escape. And, you know, throughout the show, he's being a little rascal. During its opening celebration, there was so much happening in Magic Kingdom for its November 16th, 2004 grand opening. There was, again, a huge inflatable Stitch at the entrance of Magic Kingdom and the castle. Let's talk about the castle. Now, I love the cake castle or the candy castle, sometimes people refer to for that
Me
Disney
too,
World
Jess.
Had for the 25th anniversary. And I know some people get floored that I love the cake castle. It's a love or hate thing. I'm team, I love it. So I am a castle layover lover. But this, I understand why people would have been mad about. I would have been mad about this. Cinderella's castle was only made over for one day, the day of Stitch's Great Escape opening. Cinderella's castle, the biggest icon of Walt Disney World, a symbol of hope for America, was covered with toilet paper. The concept was that Stitch TP'd the castle and graffitied the words "Stitch is King" on one of the turrets. And like, I maybe would have thought this was cool and funny if I was a local pass holder and this was just like the one day and I'm like, oh, it'd be funny to go take a picture there. It's just there for one day.
Yeah.
But this would be awful if you were a tourist and this was your first day there and this is like the only chance you maybe have in your life to go to Magic Kingdom and the castle's covered in toilet paper and red spray paint. That would be so sad. Like,
I don't know. I don't know if I would have liked it or been disappointed. I think I could have gone either way on that one.
It looks so ugly, though. It looks so ugly. And I just don't understand why they would do this to the castle. Like, I know it wouldn't have been as impactful in terms of a visual, but like, again, they have to think about the guest experience as a whole. I'm like, they could have done this all across the bridge towards Tomorrowland. Like, they could have had like the graffiti on the way on the bridge to Tomorrowland leading to the ride. I don't know. There was a castle stage show ceremony, which included the one and only appearance of a face character of Cobra Bubbles.
So
he introduced the show and he was basically being like, be on the lookout for Experiment 626.
Okay,
and
cool.
Then they had the regular stage show of like Mickey and Friends and the Princesses, and then Stitch crashed the show. with a slew of Elvis impersonators performing on the stage. And there was also a very bizarre commercial for the attraction during this time, showing Stitch throwing out thrones and other things out of the castle. And then, like, Cinderella and Prince Charming were, like, looking shocked and appalled as their house was being destroyed. And then there was a 2D animated Stitch who was like, "Ooh, much better." And then once the castle was completely trashed to his liking, he then burped and ate a booger. So,
I can handle. The booger eating is a little much,
I
know, for
but
me.
That's what they, like I said, with those commercials that I played at the beginning of my portion, like, they had him hitting on the princesses, and this, it's like they were trying so hard. It seemed like such an early 2000s gimmick where I feel like Disney was so focused on, this is branded for girls, this is branded for boys. Oh, and I feel like they were so focused on that because, like, the Stitch that we have nowadays for things, he's like always Surfing Stitch or Tropical Stitch or like Ohana Stitch. They never have like disgusting burping booger eating Stitch like they did during this time. And it's like they were like, let's have him trashing a castle and then burp and eat a booger. And then they'll be like, yeah, this is for boys.
Whoa, I love boogers. He loves boogers. I better go see and this. Like,
they don't do that kind of stuff with Stitch now because it just didn't work. And also because, you know, companies have learned we don't need to brand things as like, this is for boys only. This is for girls only, you know.
By the way, Jess, I really like your Stitch impression. It's very good.
Thank you. I was nervous because I feel like I try so hard to do impressions accurately, and I'm like, I don't know how my Stitch is. But anyway, I feel like the Stitch that they have in appearances now is much more accurate to the Stitch in the movie and not this weird, desperate attempt at we need things to market towards boys, like how it felt like they were trying to do. Anyway, so I rode this attraction. I didn't like it because it's painful. Oh. So, like, the shoulder bars that are on you, like, there's parts where you're completely in the dark, and it's supposed to be, that's the portion when, like, Stitch escaped. Yes. And so he's supposed to be, like, bouncing around the room, and so the shoulder bars, like, bounce up and down on your shoulders because it's supposed to feel like Stitch is bouncing on you. And both Garrett and I, my husband, we rode it the one time in 2013, and then we never rode it again because our shoulders were in pain the whole rest of the trip. Oh, like, they felt sore. Like, it felt so sore. And we were just like, that was so painful. Oh, and that was a common complaint. It was not fun.
No.
Also, there's a portion in Stitch's Great Escape that was notoriously hated where he has a chili cheese dog burp. He's supposed to, like, have taken a chili cheese dog from a guest, and it smells like onions and chilies and sulfur, and it's disgusting. Ew. And, like, people would complain that it would make them incredibly nauseous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I wonder if they had more cleanups on that ride because of that.
I know. Like, nothing worse than, like, your shoulders being in pain, you're feeling claustrophobic in the dark, and then it smells like
a chili cheese burp. Yeah.
Yeah, horrible. When I was, like, looking up more information about the ride, I even saw it has a Yelp page, which I didn't even realize there were Yelp pages for individual Disney attractions.
I didn't either.
But on the Yelp page, like, someone wrote a review, like, last year, and the ride closed in 2018. So this is still on their mind, I guess. But they were saying that they're so mad at this ride because they've literally never been able to eat anything that's, like, chili cheese ever since. They're like, I can't enjoy chili cheese fries anymore. And maybe it was a joke review, but whatever, it was funny.
Jess, where is the justice? The justice the for justice? Those who love chili cheese and can no longer consume chili cheese.
I know. In 2016, Disney announced Stitch's Great Escape would just operate in a seasonal operation during busy times only. Then on January 6, 2018, it closed without warning. Disney never made an official announcement it was closed. Some people assumed, okay, it's done with its seasonal operation, it'll reopen when it's busy again. But, like, a lot of people who, you know, follow Parks News closely and patterns, they were like, they're never reopening. Mm. People are just like, it's not going to reopen. It was, like, already having such low attendance for years. It was never a popular attraction ever, even when it first opened. So people were like, it's closing for good. And there was no official statement made. And nowadays, it's just the show building. I don't know how much of the attraction is still there, but nothing has replaced it. There's only a Stitch meet and greet near the entrance that they've had there now for 3 years. Wow. And aside from a Stitch meet and greet, nothing has replaced it. And I think it's kind of telling of how people didn't care that much about this attraction, because mm-hmm. I feel like normally park goers would be like, don't get rid of an attraction just to have it sitting there and not have anything replace it. But people are like, I'd rather have just a Stitch meet and greet than that ride.
Well, so, and you know, at Walt Disney World, if they close an attraction sometimes, they'll just put a curtain over it. So, you know. Yeah,
that's kind of
they have so much room, they don't even have to replace it
yet. Yeah, so it's a huge show building with no attraction in it for 3 years now.
Yeah.
And then people were like, oh, okay, it's not reopening, when the now defunct Twitter account, Backdoor Disney, which I don't encourage, like, the taking of backstage photos, but I feel okay saying the Twitter name because I'm not promoting them because they no longer exist.
Yeah.
But they posted a stripped Stitch animatronic. Like, it was just the bones of the animatronic.
Aww.
And all of his fur and, like, the skin was gone. So people are like, okay, it's not coming back.
yeah.
Other instances are the Enchanted Tiki Room. Stitch presents Aloha Iko Momai, which is at Tokyo Disneyland's Adventureland. And I know that a lot of people don't love when new IP is integrated into a classic attraction, but I'm not anti that. And I really like the idea of Stitch in the Tiki Room. That I'm also a Stitch fan, so I'm biased, but...
Yeah, and we still have Disneyland, which is the original, like, classic version. Like, I think it's fine.
And while the Tiki Room opened at Tokyo Disneyland as the same version we have, but in Japanese instead of English, in 2008, they incorporated the Stitch overlay, which opens to the bird singing Hawaiian roller coaster ride, which I thought was really
cute. Sounds cute.
But Hawaiian roller coaster ride, their song gets interrupted by who?
Who is
Stitch, of course. He interrupts, and the cast of the Tiki Room allows him to perform in the show as long as he doesn't interfere and interrupt the flow of performance anymore. At the end, Stitch declares the audience his ohana, and he looks so cute. He has a Hawaiian shirt on, and he's playing a ukulele, and I'm glad that we stayed away from Burp and Booger Stitch for this one.
I want to see it. That sounds so cute.
It's on YouTube. It's in Japanese, but it's still, like, super duper cute. Not like that matters, but it's just his voice sounds a little different because obviously it's not Chris Saunders voicing him for that one, but it's so, so cute. The animatronic's so good.
Aww.
There's also the Stitch Encounter at Disneyland Paris in Tokyo and in Shanghai, which is similar to Turtle Talk with Crush, if you've done that, but with Stitch, which I want to do that.
I want to talk to Stitch.
I want to do that so badly. Other instances, of course, are his cameo in the Disneyland show that is no longer a thing, which makes me sad, Mickey and the Magical Map.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Small World at Disneyland. During the 2008 refurb of It's a Small World, some Disney characters were added, and they added Lilo and Stitch in the Hawaii area of that ride.
I love it. So cute.
The Ohana Breakfast at the Polynesian Resort, which I've only done once, but oh my gosh, it was so much fun. I loved it. And the characters come around very frequently, which is nice. And the PCH Grill, which Melanie mentioned, which is the character breakfast at Paradise Pier Hotel at Disneyland Resort. And the show Wishes on the Disney Cruise Line ship, the Disney Fantasy Fantasmic at Tokyo Disney Sea, and Stitch's Supersonic Celebration, which is a stage show in Tomorrowland at Walt Disney World. So Melanie, which of these Stitch theme park experiences would you want to experience the most? It could be current or defunct.
Well, as much as I would like to talk to Stitch in, like, a Turtle Talk type setting, I really love, like, interacting with the character. I love how Stitch acts when he's in person. He's very playful and mischievous. So I think I would like to do the Polynesian breakfast. That sounds great. Two of my favorite things, Stitch and breakfast.
And they have the most amazing, like, sticky bread pudding that they're known for. It's so good. It's so good. I think I'd want to do that again. And an experience that I haven't done that I'd want to do the most would be the Enchanted Tiki Room.
That sounds so cute. Yes. I just want to go to Tokyo Disneyland. Everything's cuter there.
Everything's cuter. I would need I need to save up because I know I'd want to get... I can't hold back on souvenirs someday when I go. So I'll need a lot of preparation.
You will need a lot of money to go.
So that is the history of Lilo and Stitch, and we probably could have had this be a 5-hour episode.
We could have, but
there's a lot we'll of settle stuff for an hour and 20 Lilo minutes. And Stitch. We will do that. And as I mentioned earlier, we also do have a Patreon if you want some more Disney history aside from our main feed episodes. Mm-hmm. So you could find our Patreon at patreon.com/cartoons2castles, and there's different tiers. Some include merch with our logo and things like that, but the starting tier is only $3, and you get to find out first what our episodes are for the next month, and the cherry on top is getting a bonus episode about an extra niche topic, and I'm just going to read to you guys the episodes that we've done so far, so if you join, you would have access to these on the dashboard. Our first one was about ABC sitcoms filmed at Disney World, so think like the TGIF sitcoms. We talked about Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Full House, Family Matters, Step by Step. That one was really fun. And we also did one about the Star Wars holiday special. Mm-hmm. We did one about birthdays and celebrations at the park. So the 25th anniversary with the Cake Castle, Disneyland's 35th anniversary, things like that. And in February, we did kind of a little bit of a throwback tie-in when our first episode ever on our main feed was about the opening day of Disneyland. We thought it would be fun to also do an episode about the opening day of Disney California Adventure Park. Melanie picked our topic for March since it was her birthday. We did one about Totally Minnie.
Totally Minnie.
Totally Minnie. And we also did one about the whole Where's Buzzy? We did one about the history of Cranium Command, a defunct attraction at Epcot. And then if you remember the whole Where's Buzzy animatronic thing of a couple years ago, we talked mm-hmm. about that and we gave our theories. And we also most recently did one about the notorious feud between Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, and Roy E. Disney during the Disney Renaissance. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. You can find our podcast on social, Cartoons to Castles on Instagram and Cartoons Castles on Twitter. And you could find me at The Healthy Mouse on Instagram and TikTok and Healthy_Mouse on Twitter.
And I am at Keep Quirky on Instagram and Keep Quirky OC on Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Till next time, keep dreaming.